Computer game developer Zoe Quinn's life was turned upside down 3 years ago last month. An abusive ex posted an angry online manifesto about her, and that manifesto spread online. Soon she was the target of a coordinated online campaign of harassment, threats, and intimidation, with personal contact info released online and rape threats and death threats arriving in online forums, emails, and phone calls. The campaign became known as Gamergate. It spread to target her friends, family members, and anyone who publicly defended her. A lot of people, including people in the legal system, told her she should just leave the internet. She didn't. Instead, she started the Crash Override Network, a crisis hotline and advocacy group for other people facing similar threats. Zoe Quinn's games include Depression Quest. Her new book is Crash Override, How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Hate. Zoe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I briefly described, Zoe, what you went through, and it's hard to do it justice. Can you talk about the kinds of intimidation and threats that you faced and how it affected your life?
Sure. I mean, it was everything from people sending me like disgusting sexually charged messages to threats of sexual violence and death to in-person stalking, harassing my family, getting my home address, my phone number, getting that of my family, and, you know, calling that constantly, spreading nude photos of me that they would sometimes do gross stuff to. You know, like it's harder to think of what didn't happen. Pretty much anything you can do with another to another person using a computer, I kind of went through.
And you literally, in effect, lived in hiding for a while, right?
Yeah, for I believe 7 months, if I can try to pull that off the top of my head. All this started going down when I was away from my apartment, and when people were sort of like outside, like after they found out my home address and were kind of waiting for me to come back, I was like, okay, well, clearly I can't go back. I should wait for this, you know, to die down. And then after months and months and months, it was clear that that wasn't going to be the case. So I ended up having to move.
What do you know about who did this? Who was behind this very coordinated campaign of harassment and threats?
Aside from my ex, who was like kind of cheerleading a lot of it during it, you know, he would have like a weak, you know, harassment is bad disclaimer while feeding more information to the mob and encouraging them to use different tactics. There were, you know, it's hard to say there's any one specific type of person. You get like the people who just like maybe send a mean message and then never think about it again because maybe their buddies are, or they think they're like super funny or whatever. And then you've got the people who like have a very specific vendetta that are sort of against usually something they think that I represent rather than me personally, that will like kind of be symbolically attacking me as like a convenient placeholder for this thing they already feel anxious and messed up about. And then you have like the people who are kind of like ringleaders in the mob and sort of using this to like start building an online brand, and some of these people merchandise. Usually they do it under their legal name. And that's like online harassment is kind of becoming a cottage industry with people sort of spearheading those efforts.
And leaders of what became this Gamergate movement, an informal movement, I guess, claimed this had something to do with the phrase was ethics in gaming journalism. And so that manifesto from your ex claimed that you had slept with a game critic for good reviews, though the person in question never actually reviewed any of your work. So what do you see as the motivation behind what became Gamergate?
It's kind of funny. Like the manifesto actually didn't make that accusation. That
was
just something.
It wasn't the original. Okay.
Yeah, like it wasn't, I think, until a few days in that somebody else just retroactively decided that must have happened because, you know, women can't make games or whatever the reason was. The fact that that review never existed never seemed to matter. So Gamergate really, and this was very much like, seemed like by design by my ex, capitalized on this sort of growing background resentment towards anybody that's not, you know, conceived of as the default in someone's mind. And that's usually like basically the further that you get from a 1950s sitcom dad, the more of an other you are. And that's not unique to gaming by any means, and neither was Gamergate. A lot of the participants had no stake in the video games industry whatsoever or didn't even play games. Like, the name comes from the actor Adam Baldwin, who tweeted out a weird YouTube conspiracy video about how I was somehow manipulating an entire industry with makeouts with the hashtag Gamergate, and he doesn't even play video games. So really, it just was like this anti-progressive sentiment, and I was like being attacked as a symbol of, you know, progress that maybe people resented or didn't understand or feared because it was different.
Talking to Zoe Quinn, author of Crash Override, How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and How We Can Win the Fate Against Online Hate. Zoe, one of the many surreal things about your story is, as this is going on, and you're a savvy internet user, you were able to go to some of these online forums that most of us don't know exist and watch people in real time plotting out their next course of attack against you. Can you talk about what that was like?
It was difficult. You know, I'm best known for a game about having depression. So, you know, if you're familiar at all with how depression works, it's you've got this thing that I like to call trash brain, just kind of whispering all these things to you and trying to undermine your victories and be like, oh, people don't really like you and stuff like that. So having that sort of externalized like this and like fed back to me by thousands of strangers, like 24/7, was really hard to accept. And there was a part of me that was like, yeah, I knew it. I knew nobody could actually like me. I knew everybody that supported me was like either lying or they just didn't know that I'm like this horrible monster that my depression tells me I am. And I was so sure that everything was over. And that, you know, that was the end of the road for me.
And you made this game about depression. You've been public about dealing with depression. People came to an online forum related to your game to talk about their own problems with depression. And then some of the people in this anti-you movement basically tried to use that. They tried to trigger your depression. I believe you wrote that they went to this forum and tried to convince people there who had depression to kill themselves.
Yeah, it was a major thing in the attacks, both against me and part of it was like, oh, if we can isolate her from anybody who supports her or likes her, then she'll be more likely to, you know, actually kill herself. So let's try to do that.
And you were counseled by people you knew, others, a magistrate when you tried to take this into the justice system to just get off the internet, get off the online world. What was your reaction to that?
When in the case of hearing that from a judge, I was like, well, Your Honor, I'm an independent video game developer. There's not actually an offline version of that. So essentially, you're asking me to give up my career. And he said, oh, you're a smart young kid. Find a new career.
We could spend a lot of time talking about what you went through, but I also want to talk about what you've done in response. And one of the things you did was start the Crash Override Network. Tell us about that.
Crash Override Network was sort of born out of like that monitoring that we had been doing for so long of the attacks against me. And as it quickly spread out to so many other people, we were sort of trying to get, you know, as we were like quietly documenting all of it, we would see who they were going to next and like try to warn them. And, you know, we were familiar with sort of what would happen because it had already happened to us. So we'd be like, here, make sure you do this, this, and this, and it'll make it harder for people to try to like get into your accounts or find your personal information or find your family. And after a few months of doing that, it was like, okay, well, maybe we can like try to formalize this into sort of a grassroots organization and create guides and basically like give the world the tools that we have at our disposal and make it, you know, make the thing that we wish existed when we were targeted. And, you know, since what happened with me blew up so big that, like, you know, I spoke at the U.S. House of Representatives and the United Nations, so many people who had been through this sort of abuse had come forward to me and were like, oh, I feel like you're the only person who understands, you know, what I went through. So it was really apparent how many how common this stuff is, and how, where exactly the failings were. So it's like trying to figure out how to fill those gaps in while we push for institutional change and, you know, use the networked nature of the internet that, you know, can enable abuse like this to do the opposite, to look after each other and protect each other and build resiliency in our communities and teach people good digital hygiene and self-defense.
Yeah, your story was one of maybe the two or three most famous stories of this kind of online mob style harassment. But how common is it? How many people are you hearing from who have been through some version of what you went through?
See, that's the thing is like the internet is, you know, it's an extension of everyday life. So all of the bad stuff that happens offline can bleed into online just as easily, and, you know, vice versa. So it's really common with domestic violence and abuse cases now for, you know, abuse that that starts offline to continue online, like both in my case and in plenty of others. It's really common. There's a whole thing with non-consensual intimate imagery where people have nude photos of you and then you break up and then they start spreading them around. And, you know, it's the same for hate crimes. And, you know, people of color, especially trans women of color, get the most hatred and violence both online and offline. So it's really just a mirror of the offline world.
Zoe Quinn is with us. Her new book is Crash Override: How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Hate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you know been the target of online harassment or threats? How did you react? What did that do to you? Did the authorities, whether an internet service provider, a social media site, legal authorities, help in any way if you reached out to them? What do you think could or should change to deal with this kind of online harassment and intimidation? Call in now at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation. Hear some advice from Zoe Quinn coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Zoe Quinn, computer game developer. She was the target of an online campaign of threats and harassment starting just over 3 years ago. She writes about her experience in her book, Crash Override: How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life, How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Hate. She's also the founder of the Crash Override Network, which aims to help people going through a similar situation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'd like to hear from you if you've been through this or witnessed this kind of online intimidation. And if you work in schools or law enforcement or social media, let us know your perspective and how your organization deals with these issues at 800-642-1234. Zoe, I want to get your thoughts. When we hear about, you know, bullying in schools, people talk about a lot about the bystanders and what the third party can do to help out. In this case of online intimidation and threats, is there something where somebody sees this happening that they can do that's actually helpful?
Oh, absolutely. That's actually the most helpful thing that we've seen throughout all of the casework that I've helped handle is the biggest thing that tends to be a good predictor of a more positive and healthy outcome for the person affected is having community support around them that's sort of savvy, that knows what's up, which is really cool because it's like, you know, governments, big tech industry, like all of those are big institutions that take a long time to change and adapt and grow. But, you know, taking care of each other is something that we can do right now and we don't have to wait to do. So, you know, all of it really comes down to the person who's being directly affected. You know, there's a lot of different things, a lot of different feelings and responses people have to this sort of attack on themselves. So, you know, one person might want someone to stand up and like say something, and another person might just want to, you know, get it to go away and be distracted or have it removed. So really the biggest thing is to center the consent and specific needs of the person targeted before, you know, just jumping in. And another thing to do is to just going beyond when somebody is being actively targeted, build these sort of resilient channels into our community as we go. So, you know, get familiar with people in your life. If you see somebody having a hard time, like just reach out and check in and be like, hey, I'm thinking of you. Or, you know, be loud and make sure that people know that you're there to help if the worst does come to pass. And similarly, like have hard conversations with people in your life if they are, you know, maybe spreading disinformation or being, or, you know, behaving badly, being, you know, like being part of the problem, or even just like, you know, being a little bit ignorant of the problem. Do what you can to educate people.
Yeah, you write that you had a time in your life, I think in high school, where you write that you were unpleasant to people and you learned better. You changed, and you say that suggests to you that it's really important to find out what's motivating people who are doing this and not just think of them as those people.
Yeah, exactly. Because if you turn it into a good person, bad person dichotomy, then, you know, the so-called bad people can't ever grow and change and, you know, become something else. And the so-called good people get off the hook for, you know, actually hurtful behavior. So focusing more on the ways that we treat each other and trying to build nuance back into the internet, I think, is such a crucial thing. Like, nuance and empathy are like two big things that seem to be they quickly go by the wayside anytime there's any critical mass of people involved with stuff.
Let's bring on a caller now. David is with us in Appleton. David, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. The reason I'm calling is my nephew was both cyber and physically bullied in high school. And it was one of the things where, you know, everybody, they have all these programs for anti-bullying in the schools, but what they don't realize is that cyberbullying can have the same effect. And with there should be something that should go into effect where they can backtrack the ISP from the bully and have some kind of punishment for his actions like they do for physical bullies.
David, thanks for bringing that up. Zoe, any thoughts on cyberbullying where in a school, you know, you could get bullied all day at school and then bullied all night online?
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that happened to your nephew. It's really unfortunate. And that's sort of where a big kind of gap that needs to be closed right now on this issue is, you know, segmenting it out in between online and offline stuff, when it's like a lot of this stuff does start, you know, in real life from people who know the person targeted. So, you know, without, you know, accidentally, like the internet's like kind of a complicated thing when it comes to matters of privacy and being able to obtain private information and locating people. That's like a whole big thing. I think that it's important for the people that are teaching our kids that, you know, have these programs that are anti-bullying, that focus on in-person bullying, also start to sort of adapt to a modern age where, you know, that continues into the offline life. So it's like a lot of older systems for that sort of thing really need to be retrofitted and, you know, kind of caught up to date.
Thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Zoe Quinn. Her new book is Crash Override, How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Hate. Zoe, a weird sequel to your story. A lot of the people and platforms involved in the campaign against you, the threats against you, there's a lot of overlap with that and what we now know as the alt-right. And the website Breitbart was a frequent host of attacks against you. And so it's entered into the political world, too.
Yeah, it was really kind of hit a critical mass as soon as it spread into this what we're calling the alt-right now circle, which was weird because it was the actor Adam Baldwin that, you know, started that, and he had a big following in that circle. And then Breitbart, they have like their own custom art and tag for me and stuff like that. It's really bizarre because it's like I'm just an independent game developer. It's very weird to be hyper fixated on random people, but that happens all the time. It's harkens back to this cottage industry of harassment. It ties very neatly into that sort of tabloid journalism of practicing 2 minutes hate against specific people, 1984 style, except it's like instead of the government mandating it, it's private citizens and companies that are profiting off of it. And it was very weird to see, you know, how much steam Breitbart was able to gather in sort of younger, more tech-savvy crowds that they had not previously really cornered the market on yet, by, you know, dipping their toe into coming after what was happening to me, and how that spread out to other this like constellation of networked groups that hate different kinds of people recreationally as like a community thing, and then like entering into that whole sphere was really like kind of escalated things to an even more dangerous place, because that's where like you're dealing with Stormfront and neo-Nazis and like people that, you know, the same places that Dylan Roof and Elliot Rodger and a lot of people who go on to commit in-person violence just based on, you know, like hate crimes like post. It was really kind of terrifying.
Yeah, and that's one of the many most chilling things about your story and other people going through this. When somebody makes a threat of physical violence against you, you can't tell if it's just some teenager showing off to his friends or the next Dylan Roof or other you know, mass homicide perpetrator.
Yeah, and it only takes being wrong once to lose everything.
So when you look at the people who own the tubes of the internet, if you will, the social media companies, the internet service providers, are there things you'd like to see from them that could help with all this?
Absolutely. It's frustrating because a lot of platforms have terms of service that, you know, don't want that, like, in name, don't allow this sort of thing to happen. Like, it's not, you know, they've made terms of service saying, hey, like, you know, we have anti-harassment policies and stuff, but they don't actually enforce it. And what they seem to deem harassment keeps being like a moving goalpost. And really the difficulty is that the internet runs on this economy of attention where, you know, the amount of traffic to a website or engagement with a specific piece of content online is seen as value. And at the end of the day, it's just making numbers go up. And it doesn't really matter if those numbers are going up because people are like trying to hurt someone or because people found something that they genuinely enjoy. And, you know, it's such a tricky thing to try to work around because one of my biggest worries is that there will be over broad legislation that will completely stop the ability of the internet to function or will, you know, think that anonymity is the problem when it's not, and like unmask the like, oh, if we can just unmask these people, everything would be fine. And it's like, actually anonymity is good for people like me that need to hide from people like that. And privacy is a great thing. So I'd like to see more attention paid to, instead of like focusing on specific individual people who are participating in harassment, holding companies accountable to their own guidelines in terms of service. And you don't even need to get into the whole free speech versus harassment arguments. You can just make it a quality issue, like a consumer safety thing. It's like, was this platform designed with this sort of behavior in mind? If not, then it needs to be tweaked. And that's, you know, that's how spam was handled in the early 90s. And advertisements are way more of like way more free speech than death threats, which are not actually protected speech. But it was like there was so much spamming of these advertisements that it was impeding the ability for certain things to function.
And we have to leave it there. Thanks to Zoe Quinn. Her new book is Crash Override: How Gamergate Nearly Destroyed My Life and How We Can Win the Fight Against Online Hate.